I must fully admit, with the expectation of some groans, that today is going to feel a lot less like a Sunday school class and a lot more like a history lesson. There's some ground that we need to cover, because the goal of this class is the application of the Reformed faith to the life of the church. What do I mean by that? I mean that we practice the means of grace. I just prayed about it. We spur one another on to love and good works. And we do that from within a system of beliefs. Our church has a shared set of beliefs. You shorthand that by calling it Reformed Christianity, or Christianity, if you're really smarmy, from a biblically perspective, which the Reformers happen to claim. That system of doctrine informs what we do, how we do it, and what we do with it. And I thought it would be helpful for just, we've got a couple of months while Austin's doing the Inquirers class, to think about how these things we believe fit within the stream of history, how these things we believe have historically been organized and categorized so that we can use them more effectively, and then what does it look like to use them more effectively? So over the next probably 7 weeks, we're going to try to hit three big questions. Where does our doctrine fit in the stream of history? How do we organize or systematize that doctrine so that we can talk about it and use it and think about it more effectively? And then, what impact does this particular doctrine have on the life of the church in worship and in fellowship and life together? So we're going to hit that in 7 weeks, no problem. I always hit my time marks, not even close. So today is going to be a little bit, I hope it's going to be an interesting history lesson, but today is going to be a history lesson, because we've all got to get the same broad understanding of the progress of doctrine over time. And with today's history lesson, my goal is to prove the point, or to prove the purpose of this class, to prove why a class like this makes sense. And I hope that we'll see that as we think through the history. So we'll cover ground on why the system of doctrine evolved how it did, in what context, which is the history that it evolved, and then we'll get to the what and the what do we do with it over the next 6 or 7 weeks. So it feels really bad that you're teaching a Sunday school class, and today we probably won't even open our Bibles. It's just the nature of today's groundwork is prepping us for opening our Bibles in future weeks. But we got to start with why we would open the Bible at all. So we have to start with the concepts of truth and worldview and the importance of a system of truth. There have always been threads throughout the history of thought that try to denigrate or disparage or look down upon people who think too much or try to organize thought too much. Now, you can definitely become so philosophically, intellectually focused that you're not useful to anyone. That is absolutely true. Read the 4th century. But read this 18th century. But you also can fall off the other side of this horse where you say, I don't need to be thoughtful or structured or systematized about thought itself, about knowledge itself, about truth itself, because that stuff just sort of takes care of itself. You know what's true. Well, what does truth mean? Like Pilate asks, what is truth? And so it's really important that we have and understand a system of truth. There has to be some coherent way of thinking about things and of understanding things. And whenever you interact with somebody who you think has a very laissez-faire, unconcerned, unintentional, non-purposeful view of reality, when you find somebody who hasn't thought much about thinking, you're going to find a bundle of contradictions. You're going to find somebody who half of what they say and half of what they say they believe is completely incoherent given the other half of what they say and what they believe. So they can believe deeply that there's no absolute truth, and they can believe that your intolerance is unacceptably immoral and the worst trait against human virtue. Both of those things cannot be true. And yet we live in a world where people are what a professor of mine called happy bundles of inconsistencies. And so you need to have a system of truth, a coherent way of looking at things. And the importance of that system of truth is usually hidden because, and this is something that will come up in the class, most of what we're engaging with throughout the week, most of what you're dealing with in your life and even in church life is not at the level of these absolute truths. It's at the layer of applying. What do I do with them? What is therefore? It's at the level of therefore. That's where we live. This thing is true. Therefore, I need to work a certain way or prioritize certain things or treat my children a certain way. Or the therefore is where we live. And so the therefore can often hide the ultimate. And we forget the ultimate or we're not focused on the ultimate because we're dealing with the therefore, which is fine. But we've got to be drawn back to that question of ultimates regularly for the true up. And that's part of what worship is supposed to do. It's part of what you do in a miniature but still very important form with daily prayer or daily scripture or devotions is you're doing a very quick true up. Before I focus my time and attention and energy at the level of therefore, how I live, let me have my daily reorientation with ultimate truth and God himself. And then worship is supposed to be the big version of that. In fact, so big, God sets a day aside for it, not just to make sure we show up at church, but he sets aside a whole day for it so that 1 in 7 of our time is spent on this reorienting activity. And that's actually a really good lens to think about Sabbath keeping. We can get all wrapped around the axle of, am I allowed to do this? Should I do this? Is this helpful? Is this good? What's okay on the Sabbath and what's not? And a great framework is this helping me be oriented toward the ultimate, toward God himself? Christian fellowship is certainly that. Service alongside Christians can be that. Recreation can be, or also can very much be antithetical to that, depending on what recreation we're approaching. So as we think about that, it's that the day for that being reorienting toward ultimate, am I keeping it in a way that's helpful with that? Because all of life, necessarily so, pulls us one layer down from the ultimate to the therefore. Does that make sense? And where you're really living the Christian life, where you are thriving under the lordship of Christ, is when you can live in the therefore with an eye toward the ultimate. It's like Austin talked about a couple weeks ago in the things of earth and enjoying those things and participating in those things fully, but seeing all the way through them to rejoice in the giver. That is thriving in the Christian life, and it's actually available in all areas of life, even as it is appropriate that our attentions are shifted in priority from the ultimate to the therefore. The ultimate informs all of life. This gets at another one of the great myths of the history of thought, which is this separation or bifurcation of religion and life. Oh, I have my faith, I have my religion, I have my faith-based practices, I have the things that make me feel good and okay, and then I have the rest of life. I have my work, I have my pursuit of money, I have science, I have whatever else, and there's this separation of those things, and it's not that at all. The ultimate is ultimate over all of it. It's all-encompassing. That's why it's ultimate. And then no matter what aspect of life you're in, there's a line you can trace back to the ultimate. There's something that created that therefore. What am I to do in this realm of life can only be answered by what we believe about the ultimate. what is available to me and what I ought come from those ultimate. So the worldview, when we talk about that word or that concept, worldview really just means your view of the ultimate. What is your conviction, understanding, knowledge, awareness of the ultimate? That's what worldview is. And so that determines everything. And as we go through history this morning, you will, I've hopefully organized this in such a way that you'll think not just about religious thought, ultimate thought, but you'll know these periods of history well enough to think about military thought and economic and political thought, and you'll see that these are always informed by the ultimate. There's no system of thought in history having to do with anything that is not deeply connected to some worldview, to some ultimate. Your theology determines how you use your resources. Think about what you believe about the ultimate determines how you use your resources. That's true in a family, it's true in a church, but it's also true in governments and nations and militaries. And so you can trace backwards from actions of history, activities of history, to worldviews and see how you got from one to another. Some, the connection can be hard to see. Some, the connection is more obvious. So you think about Islam is not shy at all about showing this values and policy relationship the way some worldviews are. You clearly know what Al-Qaeda's plans are, and you clearly know the theological reasons that are behind them, that are driving them. What would it be like if Christianity were made that clear to the world? This is what we're doing, and this is why we're doing it, and it's good for the world. One other thing about worldviews is all worldviews are God-based religions. Who is your ultimate is who is your God? It's the same question. And just because you're a God-based religion doesn't mean that you like God or religion. Some religion-based worldviews are full of galvanized secularists who say that there is no God and religion is bad. But as you press that for logical consistency to understand what their ultimate really is, they have a God. It's usually them, or people just like them. But there's always a God. There's always a religion. God is about what is ultimate. Religion is about how I act in service of that ultimate. What are the liturgies, the cadences, the patterns of activity that are consistent with that God? You think Marxism doesn't have its religious practices and cadences? You think postmodernism doesn't have its religious? They all do. So just because you're hating God and against religion doesn't mean that you're not a God-based religion, which is what all worldviews will ultimately become. So any questions about the concept of worldview? And then we'll start marching through history a little bit and talking about some of these. When the way I talk about this concept, worldview, and this very hard line distinction between Christian theism and everything else, when this really became, when it came to the forefront of intellectual discussion was actually after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And you have the fall of the Soviet view and of Marxism. And up to that point, the greatest divide in modern intellectual thought, where people said, oh, this is the big division, was between Marxism and capitalism. That's the most significant divide in modern thought. And so from, 1945 to 1991, that's pretty much what you see happening from governments, from the American government, from Western governments, from democracies, is the most important divide and the one where we've got to hold the most ground and take as much ground as possible is on this Marxism-capitalist divide. That was sort of the view of the ultimate division. And while that is important, that's fruit of a division. That's not the source of a division. Alexander Solzhenitsyn gave a speech at Harvard in 1978 that is one of the most important speeches of the modern age. It's called A World Split Apart, very controversial. But he said the real division that has been at play throughout human history is the division between biblical Christianity and secular humanism. Because on one side, you have the enthronement of God, and on the other side, you have the enthronement of man, or in some iterations, the enthronement of the state. And he said, that's what this is really about. And if you want to talk about how to push back against the forces of evil in this world, that discussion doesn't begin with putting down the Marxists. That discussion begins with putting down secular humanism and putting that in its place. And that split really became active and at work in the world with the secular renaissance and just this whole mentality of replacing God with man in human life. All of the roles that God has played, we should put humans in those roles so that we are the ultimate. We are the ultimate judge. And what's really sad or ironic or tragic, whatever word you want to put on it, is that history repeats itself. And so here we go again. I don't have to talk to a group about the, like this about how we see that on the left. Our political left buys this hook, line, and sinker. What's tragic is our political right does as well. And we'll talk about that more as we sort of move through history. But the idea that this Marxist capitalist divide is at the top of the stack as the most important, you could rename it because we don't, well, actually we have brought back the language of Marxism, but it's been under the language of freedom or liberty versus tyranny. That's the modern language of Marxism versus capitalism. Is you're either pro-liberty or you're anti-liberty. And is that an important fight? Absolutely. Just as capitalism, Marxism, I think, is an important fight. That's not the question. It's what is the ultimate fight? Is the problem with this world that people are anti-liberty? No. People are anti-liberty because they're anti-God. Their worldview is all messed up when it comes to ultimates. And we have political parties in the United States and in Europe and all over the world that are treating liberty as though it is that ultimate rather than a fruit of that ultimate. And when you do that, it will take you some crazy broken places eventually. But history repeats itself. This is what happens. The Enlightenment was when the godless got serious about the real source of human division. The Enlightenment is when the wrong side of this debate, the secular humanist side, went on the attack and realized we should stop attacking the symptoms, capitalism, Marxism, whatever. Let's go right at the root and let's get God out of the world. Let's have a God-free world. And that's what the Enlightenment will do. Because, and you could even hear it in their language, the Enlightenment writers and thinkers who are all in on the glory of man, do you know what they refer to as the Dark Ages? Do you know what the Dark Ages are historically in philosophical thought? It's when the West believed in God. When we use that phrase, oh, that's from the Dark Ages. The Dark Ages is an Enlightenment title for a period of time when people believed in God. That's when things were dark, according to the Enlightenment. You see how that works? So you got humanism on one side and you've got Christian theism on the other. These are the two opposing worldviews. Humanism, summarized. There is no transcendent beyond the individual, footnote, or collections of individuals like the state. But humanism is really the idea that there's no transcendent. There's nothing beyond us. Whatever can achieve ultimate status in this world is ultimate status. Had the monkeys unionized and started using tools before we did, then the monkeys would be the ultimate. But we got there first. And keep the monkeys down in cages, and therefore we are the ultimate. But that individual is the ultimate. And then you can put those individuals together into groups, oligarchs or state, and they can be ultimate too, but we'll see where that leads in a minute. So Christian theism is dramatically opposed to that. Christian theism says, no, there is a transcendent. And therefore, there is a transcendent law that restrains the individual. So secular humanism says there is nothing beyond the physical that constrains me. I am only limited by what my body limits me from doing, by what physical time and space prevent me. Otherwise, there are no other types of limits that exist. And Christian theism says, oh, there's an ultimate, there's a transcendent, and therefore you are limited, you are bound by whatever law is shorthand, that comes down from that transcendent. The way God made reality and what God expects and demands of reality are also constraints, even when they are not physical. Something can't be good just because I call it good. In a secular humanist world, that it absolutely can be good just because I call it good, because I'm not constrained by anything. But if there's a transcendent, and the transcendent has a law, again, not just rules, but the way reality is structured, which includes those rules. But if there's a transcendent, I can't call bad good and actually make it good. I can just be wrong. And that is the fundamental disconnect between humanism and Christian theism. Humanism, therefore, is going to rule people through a class of elites. Now that sounds good to us. Yeah, we're against that. Yeah, classes of elites. Classes of elites come in all forms, and they've come in all forms throughout history. In the mix of church and state of Catholicism at its peak, you could have the rule of elites even being within the institutional church and yet ruling the world for secular humanism. It can be politicians. It can be wealthy barons. Who's got the money? Well, elites can be artists and entertainers. Whoever's worldview gets to dominate what actually happens in the world. That's what I mean by elites. So when the movie stars and the artists and the entertainers stand up and say, this is what's true and right and good and beautiful, and the world comes alongside them and says, yes, they're beautiful and famous, they must be right, let's do those things, we're being ruled by elites. No differently than the Roman Catholic Church, no differently than governments in all their tyrannical forms. Rule is through an elite class. And then what also is required for secular humanism, now I'm preaching, is the media. You've always had to have a media to advance the interest of elites, because you need someone who pretends to be an objective third party off to the side telling the populace that the elites are right and good and true and have their best interest and should be followed. And media comes in all kinds of forms. What was happening in Catholic churches in that period of Roman history was priests operating as a media. And then you have newspapers operating as a media and TV operating as a media and the internet operating as a media. Anti-media is still media. Twitter is still media. QAnon websites are still media. They're doing exactly the same thing. They are trying to persuade you to listen to a particular subset of elites. And that's what life has been like always in societies. Always. Part of our obligation is to observe the way that the media is steering us toward some group of elites and see if it jives with ultimate truths or not. It's just an obligation of life throughout human history, is that this is always taking place. And so you see how that should be complicated and unsettling and difficult and discouraging, that at any given moment, what's true depends on the direction that a particular group of elites are able to persuade a larger group of people is true. That should be really unsettling. And so Christianity, Christian theism, should be this incredible refuge for thoughtful people, because, oh, thank God, there is, I mean, literally, thank God, via a transcendent law, there is truth. And by the nature of that transcendent law, there is restraint on excesses and there's a guidepost for rightness rather than just what do the elites desire today. And so Christianity is this wonderful opportunity for mental, intellectual refuge from the chaos of the world that is changing its opinion every 7 seconds and killing the people who don't agree with them. That's what the history of secular thought is. So Christian theism is this great, by transcendent law, restraint on individual and guidepost for rightness. You get that dichotomy? What questions or observations do you have about that dichotomy, especially as you think about it throughout history, including our history right now? Secular humanism and Christian theism, do you see these driving the therefore level in which we all live?
I mean, it's the ultimate truth.
Right?
I mean, ultimate truth, there's reality and truth, there's not truth.
Yes. And if you ignore that level, you get nowhere. But you also cannot live minute by minute in that level. You live at the therefore level. I have to do things. I have to go to work. I have to have food on the table. I have to engage in relationships. And so we've got to be doing regular true-ups on is my therefore, the way I live, aligned with my ultimate. Renee?
You talked about there's media, which always has been media, and you said it. I'm trying to remember exactly what you said. You talk about being objective.
Media pretends to be objective.
Is there any such thing as media ever being truly objective?
No, because there's no such thing as objectivity. There is such thing as media being good and right and true. And so in that sense, God's objectivity, they can be closer aligned with God's objectivity. Don't hear me saying media is bad. Bad media is bad. And all media is media. And what we do typically is we say, well, that media is bad because the things they say at the therefore level are really broken. So I'm going to swing away from that media. I'm going to go to this other media that says some things that at the therefore level, I like. That seems right to me. So this media is good. But we got to go one layer up. Was that common grace that they happen to be right, that democracy is better than socialism? Or is their view that democracy is better than socialism grounded in an ultimate truth that comports with God's truth? And you just don't see a lot of people doing that because it feels like a lot of work. But if you get steeped, like tea steeped, if you get steeped in Christian theology, it's not that much work. If you are well read and learned in the scriptures, and you are participating in the means of grace to get that reorientation week by week, it's actually not that much work to look at every single thing in life and just move it one layer up to the ultimate for a quick gut check.
Both sides use the media and elites.
Everyone uses the media.
And you need elites to lead you.
Yes. Why are the elites, what is their worldview? Is the analysis. And like we can do this in really flippant, easy ways. This is why I say it doesn't take very long. It doesn't take people very long to realize the connection between who you should vote for and what a celebrity says is tenuous at best. Celebrities have no moral authority to tell me who to vote for on the basis of being celebrities. So we can do that one really quick. We need to do that with all sorts of thinkers. When we're reading books written by Christian authors, or we're reading tweets or blogs written by Christian authors, what do they believe that causes them to say this? It doesn't have to be a multi-hour study. I can normally follow a Twitter thread just a few deep and say, oh. And that's what's the joke on YouTube? You're always only 4 videos away from a Nazi rally. Like, that's how you stay out of the Nazi rally. While still affirming, you know, the first video I watched on this, That, therefore, was true and good and right. That's good. And now let me reorient the path this takes back to the ultimate. Matthew?
I was going to ask, how do we implement this like a later on like conversation, but like navigating conversations with people if they were to bring up like stuff with the Crusades or like stuff historically that, like, they would be, I guess, quote unquote, like on the Christian side, but like their actions don't like reflect that? Or do we say that's not a true reflection of the ultimate and that was, or like how do we navigate those kind of conversations that like actions of people who, with the nomenclature is like Christian, but like the actions or the fruit doesn't reflect what I would say.
Yeah. It kind of depends on how sincere the person who makes that accusation is. Most people who throw out something like the Crusades have no interest in a meaningful, thoughtful conversation. If I was in a conversation with someone who was interested in that and brought up something like the Crusades, I don't think it's difficult to make the point that in every system of thought and religion, there are people who claim to practice it but do not. And one of the central tenets of Christianity is that it is filled with people who actually do trust Christ and believe the tenets of Christianity and still act in times and ways that are inconsistent with the religion itself. And so this idea that everyone has moments of hypocrisy or times or actions of hypocrisy doesn't mean there is no truth. That is that's the logical jump they're trying to get you to make. Because of the existence of hypocrisy, there is no truth. Well, at a philosophical level, that's self-defeating. If there is no truth, there is no possibility of hypocrisy, because you can't. But anyways. All right, let's run through a good 600 years of history in 10 minutes and see what happens. There's a great book from the 1940s, Kenneth Lauderette's The Unquenchable Light, where he was looking at his own culture in the 40s and trying to evaluate how it had developed in thought since the time of Christ. And so he does a really good job of organizing history by pulling this thread. And he noted three things as he pulled through that. One, Christianity is the spread of the influence of the risen Jesus. What do we mean when we talk about Christianity as a religion? What you're talking about is the influence of the risen Jesus. And you see how each of those words is really important if you were to unpack them in greater detail. Christianity has also been the most universal and biggest religion throughout history. And Christianity has not spread in an even uphill line. Christianity has come in a series of waves that we call revivals. As the culture has taken ground and Christianity has ceded ground to secular humanism, and then a revival will come and we'll take even more ground than we had before. And then there's a retreat, and then there's more ground, and then a retreat. This waves scenario is notable as you look through human history. So let's trace that path real quick, just in some big buckets. Post-Jesus, post-apostles, you get a conflict between Trinitarian Christianity and what we call classical paganism. Classical paganism was the religion of Rome. It's simply that man is God. And they could sprinkle in all of these other religions, and it looks like polytheism, and they could sprinkle in mythology and ancestor worship and whatever else. But when you get to the core of classical Roman thought, Greek and Roman thought, the dominant view is that man is God. So the practical reality of that time immediately after Christianity is you have a declining and decaying Roman Empire on one side, and you have a small but growing church, the sect of Judaism, Christianity, on the other. And that's basically where you are through medieval Christianity. You have Rome, what we call the Orthodox Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church are growing in size, in popularity, in persuasiveness, in acceptance, in intellectual thought. That Christianity is growing, and you have the rest of the world in philosophical decline, post Rome and Greece. And that gets you all the way to the 14th and the 15th century. Late Middle Age nominalism. Late Middle Age nominalism is the response to what's happening in particularly the Catholic Church, some portions of the Eastern Church, but really Catholicism. There's so much emphasis on the system that the reality of God is lost. Do these things. And these are the people in charge of these things. And all of it will always bend back toward putting man on the throne, because that's what we do. And there's so much emphasis, even among careful religious observers, religious practicers, on the practice, the word and the system, that the reality of God is lost. And this leads to an absolute crisis in the Catholic Church. Because what happens to a bunch of priests who are standing up week after week, preaching and going into confession week after week, telling people about a God they don't believe is real? What happens to those priests? You have to live with that hypocrisy. What happens to people who have to live with intellectual hypocrisy? Well, they begin to practice physical hypocrisy, moral hypocrisy. So what difference does it make? I'm a sham. The whole thing's a sham. Sham on. And I mean, all is a strong word. But when we talk about the Reformation, and part of the Reformation being to correct the excesses, the morally abhorrent, awful behavior among the Catholic clergy, this is how they got there. They didn't get there by an active decision, we're going to say one thing and do another. They got there because they stopped believing the thing. They stopped believing the ultimate. God stopped being real to them. And if you have a change at that ultimate level, what does that do to your Air Force? You're going to change your Air Force. And so revelation had become subjugated to the human mind. And there's the seed of this idea that if something can't be understood, it's not true. This whole religion becomes a sham, but it is very important to people. It is very powerful and influential in the world. It has grown leaps and bounds over the last 1,000 years. They're not just going to throw it away. And so what you get is this increased moral hypocrisy. They just put on the religious show and play pretend. And you see the Catholic clergy move away from even the most basic religious morals. You say, man, that must have been a particularly awful pope that was a serial adulterer and would murder his lovers, spouses. And you're like, no, that wasn't a particularly unusual pope. That was the clergy of the day because they didn't believe. And that lack of belief is what created this. So that gets you to the Renaissance and the Reformation. Renaissance is like 14th to 17th centuries. Reformation is 16th and 17th centuries. So that pulls us up to this. It gets us to Machiavelli. You know that name. So Machiavelli is an intellectual of the day and draws a completely logical conclusion. He looks at the clergy, the elite. Remember the clergy? Remember my elite theory from the beginning. The populace is always being guided by the desires of the elites. And so the intellectuals like Machiavelli look at the elites who are guiding them, and what do they say? This is absolute hypocrisy. There's no there there. This is just a power grab. This isn't about religion or God. This is about them getting to do what they want to do. And if I'm not competing with an ultimate, I'm just competing with these chumps, then what I want is just as valid as what they want. And now you got the Renaissance. That's where this comes from. This disdain and lack of respect for the church that starts to flourish in the Renaissance is the absolutely rational, fair, legitimate fruit of what the church was leading up to that. How does this relate to us? Anybody want to opine on history repeating itself or similarities? The insincerity of the church fueled the Renaissance. The World War II generations returned from the war created the insincerity of the church in the 20th century, which fueled massive retreat from the church, massive withdrawal from Christianity. And you see waves, you'll see in history these sort of waves of resistance. We're about to talk about the Reformation being a wave of resistance. Waves of resistance come in different potencies, levels of effectiveness, levels of truth. Right? The Reformation is a big wave. We're talking about the First Great Awakening. That's a big wave. But you know what else was a wave of resistance? The Jesus freaks. The megachurch movement. They are. We may not think that they're good on the whole, but they are absolutely little pocket waves of resistance to the insincerity of the church elite. What do we do with that? What do we do with that? Always. Always reform.
What would be considered the church elite in our current age when we're not so structured?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not sure I know. The megachurch killed the main line. So the main line is a walking corpse. I'm fully aware that mainline Presbyterianism, mainline Methodism have more numerical members than evangelical church membership. They're a walking corpse. They're utterly irrelevant to the progress. So who isn't? I don't know. It's too early to say this is the case. One of the scarier ones for me on the horizon is this online religious culture. The creation of communities in an internet context for religious unity and like-mindedness, but completely disconnected from day-to-day life with one another, seems to be very popular. And it's big tent. Jordan Peterson's not a Christian, and somehow he's in this big tent. But I don't know. It's early. We have to be watching. We have to be mapping things back to ultimates. What do we do here?
Couldn't you say, I mean, you may just be being gracious. Like, we know it when we see it. The elites are the ones who, by and large, align themselves with the cultural norms of the day.
Yeah, I mean, it was Big Eva. I just don't know what label to put on it anymore. Yeah. Like, it was Big Eva. Big Eva's dead. Big evangelicalism as a, like, Big Eva's dead. I don't know who's next. And the part of your question that's really fascinating is, will it look utterly differently from how it's looked before, given the lack of any institutional structure? It's not like there's another institution to come along and replace it. We're in a tremendously anti-institutional age of all kinds. So what will the elites look like in that context? We see it politically. This whole populist movement is this politically. What will it look like in the church? Maybe it will be one and the same. Maybe the Christian elite will be captured, taken hostage by this political populism for a while. And that will lead us to madness. But I don't know. So at the same time as the Renaissance, the back half of the Renaissance, you have the Reformation coming. So the Reformation is this wave of resistance. Secularism is on a wave to drown Western Europe. You get to the 15th, 16th century, it looks like an unstoppable force that Western Europe is going to be drowned in secularism. And then God, by his grace, sends the Reformation. And it's not like secularism is producing good fruit, by the way. Read the non-Christian thinkers of this time. It is not a happy world. It is not a happy place intellectually. Culture is in decline That's what secularism does. It destroys culture from good and true and beautiful. And so then God sends the Reformation, which is this outpouring of the Holy Spirit, leading many to turn back to the ultimate and to take hold of justification by faith, which is the only doctrine that can endure human skepticism. All other religions don't work. Philosophically, they don't work. Because as you pursue those religions up the philosophical chain, you're always going to get to the question of, yes, but I do bad things, and how does a person who does bad things get right with God? And every religion has an answer to that that either makes God less than God or makes you God. But in all the religions, you and God become equals. You have to. It's the only way it can make you right before God, is for you and God to somehow become equals. Either bring God down or move me up. And Christianity has this unbelievable doctrine of justification by faith, which says, nope, both things can happen. God does not change. He is not you. And you, who are you, dead in sins and trespasses, can be made alive, but not by your doing. Amazing. And that's why in the Reformation, you reclaim this doctrine. It pushes back the tide of secularism in Western Europe, not for a ton of time, but for a while. And you've got people not just believing justification by faith, you've got them singing justification by faith. These are our great hymns, because this doctrine has taken hold again and provided this wave of resistance in the world. The Reformation, the best estimates I've seen by theologians and historians I trust, is that the Reformation set back secular humanism 150 years. 150 years of secular humanist progress in the world were delayed because of what God did through the Reformation. And you have a similar thing happen in the Catholic Church, which is called the Counter-Reformation. The Counter-Reformation ended up with bad doctrine. The Council of Trent, no good. Says you're all going to hell anyway. You shouldn't like it. Council of Trent, no good. But what were they trying to do? Well, the Roman Catholic Church said, we got to get back to ultimates. We will never fix our moral and ethical problems in the church if we don't get back to ultimates. And so they go back to Catholic doctrine, to ultimates. It just so happens that the doctrines that had been changed and manipulated so much over history that they're not recognizable to biblical doctrine. So that gets us to the Reformation. I'll stop there. We've got just a little bit to finish next week, getting to the 17th century. This is when the absolute monarchies are going to rise. But let me spoil the ending just for a second, so I can justify why we did this today and why we'll do this a little bit more. The church is always responding to the questions that are raised by the culture in which it's preaching the gospel. The church should always be preaching the gospel in the culture that it's in. And every time the church is in a particular culture preaching a gospel, that culture has questions. Time-based questions. Now, it might be history repeating itself, but time-based questions. And the job of the church is to respond to those questions. It's not to be so anchored in the words of the church fathers in Greek and Latin that we just keep shouting Greek and Latin at a 21st century American culture. It's to speak ultimate truths, the gospel, to the particular culture in which we find ourselves. We're salt and light. The church is always asking itself, how do I explain things to pagans? How do I explain ultimate things to pagans? And then pagan converts come to Christianity and they join the church. And what do pagans do, even when they're genuine in their conversion, and they join the church? Pagan's going to pagan. They're going to bring pagan ideas into the church. And how does the church resist and overcome those pagan ideals and replace them with biblical ultimates? Doctrine. That's what doctrine is. And so there's an unchangeable aspect to doctrine, the faith handed down, the unchanging word of God, unchangeable aspect to doctrine. And there is regular change in how we articulate, how we speak of and explain that doctrine, and how we apply that doctrine to a changing world. If you think, like, that's level 300 classes. Most of your life is lived in level 300 classes in college. How do I apply this unchangeable doctrine to a changing world? You can't do that work, the therefore work, if you haven't taken the 100 and the 200 level classes to know what the unchangeable doctrine is and to see how the church has applied that doctrine in various cultures and various periods of human history. That's the purpose of this class. Is let's do a survey of how doctrine gets organized by the church and what it looks like to apply that doctrine in various historical and cultural contexts so that we can do it in our own. Otherwise, we don't do it in our own. We lose sight of ultimates, and we repeat that part of history that we should want no part of. So next week, we'll wrap up history. We'll look at systematic theology. It will feel like Sunday school again next week. We understand why systematic theology exists, and we're going to look at how it's laid out. How do you organize unchanging doctrines so that people can do the work of the 200 and 300 level classes as the articulations and the applications change?